2000 AD Thrillcast Supplemental, number 4, Steve Yowl Part 2. Borag Thung, Earthlix, and welcome to the second part of our chat with Steve Yowl, the artist on Zenith and so many more classic 2000 AD series. We've got a lot to get through in this episode and some great insight from Steve. So I'm not going to prevaricate on this episode. Let's go straight in and say welcome back to the Thrillcast, Steve.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for having me.
No worries. No worries. Now, we spoke at length about Zenith last week, but your time at 2000 AD especially has been about so much more. But what was the effect of Zenith on your career? Were there a lot of people kind of suddenly making inquiries, particularly as Grant's career has gone on to other things?
Yeah, there was. I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't say there was some American work that came out of my drawing Zenith. Mm-hmm. But obviously, with it being as high a profile project as it was, it brings you to other people's attention, and other things, you know, other doors open because of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, despite that, you've spent most of your career at 2000 AD. Mm. Is there a reason for that?
Well, less money, more freedom.
Right.
is the short answer. Mm. I've always been quite happy shunting between British comics and American comics whenever people want me. Mm. Like you say, most of my work has been for 2000 AD these last few years. I guess it's just written in the stars, isn't it? This kind of stuff, this kind of thing.
and I mean, we mentioned last week about how much more British your work is compared to so many others working in comics at the moment. Mm. How do you feel you fit into comics now? What is your place in the industry?
I'd like to think I'm flexible enough as an artist to be able to take on most projects that are thrown to me. Mm. I guess in a lot of respects, my artwork sort of sits between styles anyway. Mm. I never really had, when I was working at Vertigo, I don't think I ever really had a Vertigo style.
Yeah.
And in some respects, do I have a 2000 AD style, do you think?
I'd describe it as a 2000 AD style.
Oh, that's good. Thank you for that.
It's more just that, like I said in the last episode, when I look at your work, you know, I can't identify it as being anybody else's. Mm. It is a unique style, and I think that's one of the defining characteristics of working at 2000 AD.
We
pick the people who are different, to you know, who are unusual, and you know, they may well have an influence on 2000 AD down the line. On American comics down the line, but when they first come in, you know, you've got yourself, you've got Bisley. I mentioned people like Jock and Fraser Irving. They're fresh and unusual and interesting and different. And I think that's probably the why I think something like Zenith especially stands the test of time. Does that make sense?
Yes, that's very kind of you. But you're right. I mean, 2000 is a broad church, and it embraces many styles. And long may it continue to do so.
Yeah. I mean, we'll come on to some of your other work for 2000 AD and also for America in a second. Let's talk about your influences a bit more, because you've made a comment about an influence of Disney.
Yeah.
Explain a bit more about that.
I guess I'm just influenced by that classic Disney school of animation. Mm. I mean, the exact names of the artists involved pass me by, but there's It's the Disney that existed before. Let's see, I'm trying to think of what the last. I mean, the kind of things I used to see at the cinema as a child were like 101 Dalmatians and Aristocats and and Sleeping Beauty and because obviously Disney films, they were back in the day, they were re-released on a 7-year cycle, was it, I think?
Yeah.
I know there was a regular cycle they used to re-release them on. Mm. And it's just that school of realistic cartooning, in the sense that the kind of proportions of the figures are convincing rather than realistic. I mean, it's never entirely realistic. That school of convincingly proportioned cartooning,
yeah,
is what I enjoy. And that kind of clear line, clean, designed approach. I particularly like Sleeping Beauty, actually, because I don't know if you're aware, but all the backgrounds in Sleeping Beauty were designed by a German painter, and the characters were animated to fit in with the background.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which at the time that the animators didn't like, because they preferred much rounder, squashier shapes.
Mm.
And if you look at all those drawings in Sleeping Beauty, they're kind of a bit more angular.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because that style has gone on to influence some of the later Disney cartoons. I think like Aladdin have a much sharper, a much more straight-edged style to them. That's fascinating. But if when you first said Disney, I thought, nah, that can't be right. But the more I've thought about it, the more I see that in your art. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, and of course, you know, now we're talking on the subject of animation, all those Hanna-Barbera adventure cartoons, 1970s.
Yes.
I'm just trying to think of them off the top of my head. I never saw Johnny Quest. I'm not sure if Johnny Quest was broadcast here. Hanna-Barbera adventure cartoons that used to appear regularly in the end of the 60s through the early 70s.
I think there's things like Atamant and Space Ghost, things like that, or are you thinking more the pure sort of adventure ones?
I'm thinking more the pure sort of adventure ones. Right, Three Musketeers, that used to...
Right.
That used to be part of the Banana Split show, that.
Yeah,
Three Musketeers.
And there were things like they adapted Moby Dick and
they adapted Tarzan, didn't they?
Yeah,
Star Trek.
Right. That's interesting because, like I said, I would never have thought of that. But the second you said it, I thought, yeah, actually, I can see that ingrained into the way that you do your art.
Mm.
That also seems to be the most consistent element of your art as well. That kind of clear line style. Mm. That uses thickness of line to denote depth and form, without any kind of extra additional shading.
Mm. Yeah. Well, if it's done properly, and that of course is the element that's always sliding away from you as an artist.
Yeah,
you know, if it's done properly, if the forms are properly composed, in the masses are properly composed within the panel, then you know you shouldn't need too much extra rendering and too much extra detailing for everything to look right.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your other work for 2000 AD. I mean, before I even knew what Zenith was, there was Maniac 5. That you developed with Mark Miller.
Yeah.
And that's going from you know, yes, a fantastical superhero story, but one that's full of humans, into a very kind of action-packed robot story. Tell us a bit about how you came to be working with Mark on Maniac 5.
Well, Maniac 5 was part of the guest editorship that Mark and Grant did for 2000 AD, if I remember correctly. I think at the time I was going to be drawing The story that John Smith wrote, the name of which escapes me. But for whatever reason, they asked me to draw Maniac 5. Mm. Yeah, and you're right, there was a real energy to that writing. I believe Mark wrote it quite quickly.
For better or for worse, I think.
as he described it to me, I think he'd already written something which at the last minute was turned down. And I think he wrote Maniac 5 in a raging fury, as Captain Harry Kane used to have.
I love the idea of that. This will show them. Come on.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if you noticed, there's always an old man and a dog that appear in a lot of Miller strips at some point.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. There's the opening scene in the opening few panels, and I think it's episode 2. With the old guy with his dog in the truck that gets crushed by one of the tripods. Right. I've noticed more than one old man and dog in a Mark Miller story cropping up somewhere.
I like it. Coded references all the way through his work. How did working on something like Maniac 5, which was really just pure kind of boys sci-fi action adventure, how did that differ to working on something like Zenith?
Well, the methodology didn't change. Mm. I still sort of read the scripts as careful as I can, careful with the layouts, careful with the thumbnails. But it was just a much speedier, rushier kind of story. And I think that probably influenced my approach to the artwork. I kind of made some of it. I was looking at a lot of Katsuhiro Otomo, artist of Akira.
Yes, yeah.
At the time. And you can see it in the explosions.
And of course that strip was coloured. You mentioned in the previous episode that doesn't really influence your the way that you do your artwork much.
No.
Mm-hmm. But I find it interesting that even though it doesn't, it still seems that you give a lot of room for colourists to breathe, as it were.
Yeah, I guess we're back to that, those clear line influences on my work, aren't we?
Yeah.
I think as I said in our previous episode, I don't think I make allowances for the colourists when I'm drawing. Yeah, I think in the same way, if you look at the work of Milton Caniff, that was, I mean, those Sundays were coloured. The Terry and the Pirates Sundays were coloured. Mm. But again, just as black and white work, as standalone black and white artwork, it kind of really stands up on its own without the colour.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the philosophy of a lot of those guys in the 50s and 60s again. The artwork's got to stand on its own without the colour.
Now, I've skipped ahead a little bit, but actually that brings us nicely to another strip that you did with Mark Miller, which was Red Razors.
Mm.
Which certainly that first story that appeared in the Judge Dredd magazine fairly early on in its print run. That had so many things which I think have stayed with your career ever since the beginning of Zenith. You know, you've got the pop culture references, which is a lot heavier in Mark's work than they were in Grant's work. Grant's were always a little bit more subtle, but Mark's is a bit more of a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
But also it's a lot more visceral, a lot more violent. There's an almost kind of, I'd say, a pop art feel to it, you know, that kind of slightly square kind of futurist feel to the entire thing. Tell us a bit about Red Razors, and did you intentionally bring a different style to it?
I think if you look at Red Razors, I think the first episode is a slightly different style from subsequent ones.
Mm.
And I think it's much closer to the way I was drawing in Zenith Phase 3.
Yeah.
And it kind of, once I started drawing it that way, I sort of realised it didn't really work. I mean, the techniques I was using for Zenith Phase 3 were appropriate for a kind of gothic horror come superhero story. They didn't work with Mark's kind of approach to Red Razors. So I started drawing with a lot of marker pens, and I started looking at a lot of, kind of got out of the old Bob Oxner Supergirl strips from the 60s. Those kind of lightweight is the wrong word, but those kind of inking styles, and I think those were a big influence on me for that particular project. Along, you know, obviously filtered through all the other things that have have got bolted on over the years.
It really felt like Red Razors was a kind of response to Grant's, as I say, more subtle referencing of pop culture, but with Mark's trademark, what's the word I'm looking for?
Sledgehammer.
Yeah, I suppose I chose the right word the first time. Sledgehammer. Did you enjoy working on Razors? It just felt that there was a lot more kind of kinetic energy to it.
Yes, I did. Yeah. It was quite a productive time for me as well. I think I seem to be turning around the pages reasonably quickly. For whatever reason that was, I don't know. Maybe I was just been breathing in too much spray mount.
Well, I mean, looking at your bibliography, between sort of 89. Through to about 94, 94, 96, that is an incredibly prolific period for you, because you're not just working at 2000 AD in the Joe Shed magazine, you're also doing stuff for America, such as Sebastian O and the Invisibles. Forgive me for asking, but how old were you around about that time?
Would we say 94, 96?
Yeah.
So 94, 96, I would have been 32, 34.
Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. So, you know, that phase kind of covers your late 20s, early 30s. I suppose by that point, you're kind of confident enough in your abilities while still having, you know, a bit of youthful energy. Yeah. If you see what I mean.
Yes, yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head there, Mike. I'm not sure I could produce pages at that rate now. I think that's something we will suffer from.
So one of the strips that you worked on was Devlin War with John Smith, and you worked on it quite extensively. The original artist on that was Sean Phillips, and there's been one or two other artists that have also had a go. How did you come to be working on the strip in the first place?
It was simply, I just got a phone call from David Bishop. I know they had obviously Chasing Herod was quite a long series.
Yeah.
And I had quite a good working relationship with David. And I think because they wanted someone to, perhaps because they wanted someone to commit to, I think it was 18 months of drawing it.
Yeah, it's a biggie, isn't it?
Yeah, he got in touch with me, and I'd like to think I had a reputation for being reliable back then. So that's one of the reasons I'm sure David got in touch with me. And I was keen to work with John because I'd never worked with him before up till then.
As the series go on, you start to, deadlines start to slip a little bit.
Yeah.
But David Bishop, you said, chose you because perhaps he felt that you were a reliable hand. How easy is it to as an artist to come out, kind of maintain the pace on a long series, particularly when you've got someone like Zenith or Red Seas or Devlin War, where you're talking a long story, a lot of work. How do you keep up your stamina? How do you maintain the pace?
I've always done it, I think, by having a sort of fairly set ritual. A fairly set working day. You know, you make sure you start at a certain time. I know roughly after all these years, I know roughly how long a given stage of a drawing a strip should take me.
Yeah.
So I know after so many days, I should be at this stage of the drawing.
Yeah.
And you break it down like that. I mean, you have a target each work day and then a target for the end of the week. And hopefully that will mean that you maintain a constant schedule,
right.
A consistent schedule.
Okay. You mentioned a little while ago about Sean Phillips having done pretty much all the groundwork in terms of design. But
yeah.
What I really note about your work on Devlin is how seemingly design-led it feels. You know, you kind of boil these characters down to their fundamental characteristics. So in many ways, I think Devlin looks almost more stylistic than he had under Sean's tenure.
I guess that's just a byproduct of the way I draw. I could see the references to Terry Thomas Sean had made when he designed him. If I remember, I think I probably hunted out some references of Terry Thomas. And because my style owes something more to that kind of 1950s, 1960s school of comics and sort of classic Disney animation and that kind of thing, which is slightly more stylized than Sean's more illustrative approach. I guess that's how the changes came about.
Mm. You know, there's the Terry Thomas source there. There's you know, other stuff contained within Devlin's personality. How do you stop a character like that becoming a stereotype in of itself, a cipher, you know, two-dimensional?
Interesting. I've never really thought about that. I guess it's just, I mean, if you kind of, as part of the process, you've got to read the script pretty thoroughly anyway, so you get to know these characters quite intimately. I think perhaps, not sounding like I'm talking out of my hat here, but in the same way that writers say that the characters talk to them while they're writing them, I guess in a way they must talk to you while you're drawing them.
Right.
And they'd kind of tell you if you were doing the wrong thing. You know, you develop an instinct for what they would and wouldn't do and what they wouldn't like you to have them do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I suppose that's the way to make a whole character, really, is to feel the character.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah. And like I say, that comes back to reading the script thoroughly and kind of immersing yourself in the story. Mm. I mean, I like to read the script through three or four times before I sit down and start thumbnailing out the panel layouts. So by that point, I'm pretty familiar with what's got to happen over the course of that episode.
Mm. With Chasing Herod and Sirius Rising, rereading it, it seems to act as a kind of bridge between your kind of zenith phase and your later stuff on things like Red Seas and Black Shark and DeMarco. Where for you does it sit in that spectrum? Was it a time where you were still developing as an artist, or when you were kind of getting into full throttle?
Styles are a funny thing, really. I don't think you ever sit down and think, well, today I'm going to change my style. So what I've always found tends to happen is you can come up with a particular methodology or a particular approach that works very well for you over a period of time. And then for whatever reason, it doesn't start giving you the same results, in which case you kind of have to sort of step back from the whole thing and think, well, you know, those brush lines aren't working. Maybe I should use a pen. Or those pen lines aren't working. Maybe I should use a marker and kind of introduce something new into the process. And that kind of freshens you up. And then restarts that journey forward.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's probably where these little changes in style come from. And it's one of the pressures, obviously, of producing so many pages a month, year in, year out. I mean, Dave Gibbons, I remember saying once in an interview, it was very hard to maintain the same style over a series, probably for those very same reasons I've just chatted with you about.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting on the longer epics, seeing how people change. We'll talk about Zenith in depth, but you know the difference in your style between phase one and phase four is quite pronounced. But even something like Bisley on the Horn God, there is a clear, palpable, demonstrable change between the first page and the last page. And whether it's him getting quicker, whether it's him running out of time, whether it's him improving, whatever it is, you see the evolution on the page.
Yes, that's it. I kind of always find there's a stage in a series as well, maybe comes around the halfway point, two-thirds of the way in, where you really do hit that brick wall and you've kind of really got to grit your teeth and then you kind of just batter your way through that hurdle and hopefully finish on a high.
I'm sure
writers have the same problem.
It comes back to that kind of stamina question I asked. It's like a marathon runner.
You can
sprint the first few miles, but you'll soon run out of puff. So you've got to pace yourself over the course.
That's it, exactly. Very good analogy, Mike.
Thank you. No, I'm thinking about the kind of the hitting the brick wall. When you're two thirds, three quarters of the way through, and you realise how far you've come, but still how much further you've got to go. Has there ever been a time when you've been dispirited, where you have got to that point and thought, where am I going to go with this?
Not these days. I may have felt a little like that when I first started out drawing comics. And I can remember, well, probably at some point in the first Zenith series, because the deadline pressures felt so great.
Yeah.
I was going out for walks in the evening just to kind of clear my head. And you do think, good grief, can I get through this? Can I maintain turning in episodes every 11 days? I had to turn in that first Zenith series.
Right.
But it's just with experience. You just kind of get used to it.
Yeah.
I think John Byrne said in an interview one time that how as he was older, deadlines didn't seem as real in a way to him as they did when he was younger.
Yeah.
But I think that's just the experience thing.
We've spoken at length about your collaboration on Zenith with Grant. You have been remarkably blessed with collaborators, particularly at 2000 AD. What's it been like to see how that group of you, who all roughly started around about the same time, have gone on to various things?
It's been great. It's been really nice to see. It's great for Mark that he's as well, now is he big in films?
I think he has a size in films. Yes.
Yeah, he has a size in films. Yes, it's great that he has a size in films now. It's nice to see people kind of taking comics and jumping off into other things. Same for Grant. Grant's got some. I think he's pretty much a permanent fixture at DC now, isn't he, Grant? It's nice to see him being such an important part of the setup there.
Mm. One thing, the reason I ask is because there's one thing that you did work on with Grant for Crisis, which was the New Adventures of Hitler.
Yeah, yeah.
For those who are listening who don't know about the New Adventures of Hitler, describe it in a few words.
Hitler visits his in-laws in Liverpool in the early part of the 20th century. Yeah, it's based on a book called The Memoirs of Brigitte Hitler, written by the aforesaid Brigitte Hitler.
Yeah.
Who was married to Hitler's, I think it's half-brother, married to Hitler's half-brother, Alois, spelled A-L-O-I-S, I'm not entirely sure how that's pronounced.
Yeah.
And who was, and they were living in Liverpool around about 1912. And she claims that Hitler, possibly avoiding the draft in the Austrian army, came to visit them.
I love the fact that Grant saw that and thought, you know, that's a good idea for a comedy strip.
Yeah. You wouldn't think there was that much potential, would you?
No. I mean, what was it like working on something that was essentially out and out comedy?
Yeah, it was pretty surreal bonkersness.
Yeah.
It was nice that Nick Abadzis and Steve Whittaker got to colour it, because they brought it to a whole new level of surreal imagery. With some of that, so I don't know if you noticed, some of it is some of that colouring is actually montage in the blue lines, and it brought a whole new dimension to it, to that wackiness. I tried to approach it in a slightly more cinematic way. I felt was more cinematic than I had done previously, kind of rather than having cause and effect and action and reaction in the one panel, kind of cut away and cut to reactions. And I kept the layouts very formal. I used that 6-panel 2x3 grid quite a lot, which seemed to suit the pacing of the story much more as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've talked about the kind of influence of pop culture on Grant and Mark's writing, and I mean, case in point, Crisis was the apex of comics and pop culture, wasn't it?
I mean, especially getting Ryan to do the styling on it. That was very much a pop culture statement. Yeah.
Coming back to 2000 AD, you've done a smattering of Judge Dredd over the years. You've only done a couple of Future Shocks, but it just feels like whenever you've been off to do stuff for places like DC and Vertigo, 2000 AD has always been that constant.
Mm.
In your life, what does it mean to you? Not necessarily as an artist, but just as somebody who needs work to always have that kind of home to go back to.
Oh well, it's great. It's wonderful that they are so willing to keep me employed after all these years. Yeah, it's just lovely to have. It's that whole 2000 AD. Attitude and ethos and all embracing approach to, you know, writing styles and art styles. It's always nice to come home to.
Mm-hmm.
Meeting up with another old friend.
So many old friends. Oh, you used the word ethos there. If it's not too kind of woolly and vague, what is your ethos about the way that you work? And the kind of art that you produce, is there a central idea about what it is you want to achieve?
Well, what I want to achieve is, I owe it to the reader to make the story as clear as possible, and I owe it to the writer to follow to interpret their vision, if you like. If that doesn't sound too woody and vague, as closely as possible. I mean, in a lot of ways, as a comics artist, you are the intermediary between the writer and the reader. Mm. And it's a big responsibility, and you kind of have to be aware of these two parties when you're drawing these pages. You can't be too self-indulgent about the whole thing.
That I mean, that's an interesting take on it. It's self-indulgent, because there are some artists who are guilty of that, of kind of I suppose in a way grandstanding, you know, kind of showing off on the page. But really, the best comics are where the writer and artist are in sync with each other.
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
Have there been times in your career? I guess the most obvious one is Zenith, but other times in Zenith where you've really felt that kind of energy between you and the writer in terms of your collaboration?
You mean other times other than Zenith?
Or? Yes, other than Zenith, yeah.
Yeah, I've always got on really well with all the writers I've worked with, straight off. I mean, they all have their own little ways of working, their own little foibles. Mm. Their scripts always feel, slightly different from each other.
Yeah.
I mean, some can be far more descriptive in their panel descriptions. Morrison's panel descriptions are always kind of, they're a lot of, like little bits of literature, really. They sort of created an impression of what was wanted, rather than nailing you down too closely. Someone like Steve, Steve Moore, had a very not descriptive, not in a bad way, of writing in his panel descriptions. It was very much, so and so is standing on the left, and who the other character is standing on the right, and they're doing this and that and the other. It was just a different way of doing it.
Mm.
But I've always got on well with my writers. I guess I'm just lucky.
Well, I mean, just a cursory glance at the list of stuff you've done for 2000 AD alone. You've got Neil Gaiman as your not the first published work, but certainly the first that you drew for 2000 AD, which was a Future Shock, and then straight in with Grant on Zoids, on Zenith, you've got Mark Miller, Steve Moore. You've done a smattering of Judge Dredd with Wagner and Grant and Mark,
and of course the saintly Ian Edgington.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, what better time to talk about it then than Red Seas, the epic Red Seas, which is there aren't that many stories, I think, at 2000 AD that deserve the word epic. Not necessarily because they're great. You can talk about the sort of the mega epics for Judge Dredd and things like that. But where there's an epic story being told, and you get things like Nicolai Dante, which deserves it. But also, I think Red Seas deserves to be called an epic because it's a vast body of work. Mm-hmm. We talked last week about standing the pace on these things.
Mm.
How was it on Red Seas to keep a certain constancy all the way through those big long epic stories?
Well, there was always really Red Seas is a series of 12, 14 episode stories, which collectively make up the whole epic, and that each of them were different enough to just give you that renewed burst of energy every time you started a new story.
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, Ian's a great character writer, a great dialogue writer, actually. We kind of don't really talk about, perhaps people do talk about how important the dialogue is to the comics writing. And I've always got, as an artist, I've probably got far more out of the dialogue than I have out of the panel descriptions, really.
Mm.
Just as an aside. Ian and I both share a love of kind of B-movie kind of things, Ray Harryhausen, Roger Corman, and you can see all those influences popping up all the time in Red Seas. Plus, I mean, I really enjoy a good costume drama myself. So to get to draw that kind of thing for 10 years, was it? How many years did you draw Red Seas for?
Good God! It started in Prague 1313, and ended in 2008. Good God! It was 11 years. That's 11 years of work.
Yeah, I remember there are little bits and pieces in between.
Yeah,
so it's not 11 years straight through.
But even so, just I mean that's a vast body of work.
It is actually, yeah. And we were Ian and I were saying when you brought out the digital edition of the collected Red Seas. You forget just what size, just how big a body of work it was.
Yeah.
But to sort of spend that amount of time with those characters, with a writer of Ian's caliber, is a pleasure. Mm. What better job can there be? You're staying in out of the rain. There's no heavy lifting, and you get to draw pirates all day. What could be better than that?
It seemed that your style kind of responded to the subject matter, became a lot more open, a lot starker, because you started using spot blacks in a very different way. So a lot of the panels, particularly the huge, great big vistas, the double page spreads that you did, the amount of detail is less, but you seem to be doing more with less.
Mm.
Was that a conscious thing?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. Yeah, I'm not sure how conscious it is. I know exactly what you're saying, and I can see it myself. I think that it's kind of that approach has probably sneaked up on me over the years. With, as I was saying last week, with that having to take a step backwards in order to take a few more steps forwards with your artwork. And I think all these things have gradually sneaked up on me over the years. But, you know, without sounding too pompous, that, you know, the art is in what you leave out, not what you put in.
Right.
I've talked myself into a corner with that.
I find it a contrast between your work on something like Detonator X, where, you know, it's essentially Pacific Rim. You know, you've got these big robots duking it out. Yeah. And I wasn't 100% convinced that more kind of open style seemed to suit that. But then you get something like Red Seas, where you kind of go, well, you know, you're talking about, you know, open seas, you're talking about gods walking amongst man. And it really seemed to gel in a way that it hadn't before.
Mm. Yeah, well, thank you, Mike. I can't quite explain that. I guess we're back to those classic B influences, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah.
60s comics, you know, B movies, Disney animation. It's all in the mix there, isn't it? I mean, I like drawing a big broad horizon, a kind of a Monument Valley. I could draw Monument Valley all day.
In terms of, because you've been drawing DeMarco for the Judge Dredd magazine recently about a former judge turned private investigator. Are you comfortable in the more claustrophobic world of Megacity One?
Yes, I haven't had any claustrophobic moments myself so far. Yeah, me and Mike seem to be chugging along quite happily. And he writes some delightful scripts, and I'm enjoying drawing them.
Because it's often the reason I ask is it's often clear that some artists favour more natural environments over more constructed environments like Megacity One. So for the Judge Dredd Mega Collection, I was recently talking to John Ridgway, and despite having been known for his, Judge Dredd work alongside Luke Kirby, he said, well, I don't really like Megacity One. And if you look carefully, all my stories are where he leaves Megacity One, they're all in the Cursed Earth.
Yeah.
I looked at his stuff and went, yeah, I hadn't noticed it was the connecting factor, you know, it's when they go outside. So I just wanted to see whether, you know, there was an environment in which you felt more comfortable as an artist.
Yeah, I suppose I guess my environments are always more organic-y. But my approach to science fiction is very much in that same mould as Carlos draws, in so much everything looks like it's based around organic shapes.
Yeah,
I don't know if you noticed in a lot of Carlos's strips, there's no straight lines. Everything's curves. Everything's based on sort of seed pods and printed circuits, and it's kind of organic-y and soft lines.
Yeah, yeah.
And my kind of science fiction is nearer to that than it is to that sort of very hard-edged science fiction. I think
Well, I'm pretty sure Carlos said it at his panel in San Diego that was on a previous episode, that he sees Megacity One not as buildings rising up, but mushrooms growing.
Yeah.
Of course that has influenced everybody from Mick McMahon through to, you know, people working now, is this idea is completely overgrown.
I think there's probably little elements of Mike McMahon in my mega city, and I think I'm right in saying, if you look at the style of Mike McMahon's buildings, they're kind of they're topped off in the same kind of shapes as people's hats.
Yes.
You know, there's a style of headgear people have in Mega City One.
Yeah.
And you can see that mirrored in his building designs.
Yeah.
I've tried to do myself. I mean, I think people have picked me up on it, and perhaps it's a bit too obvious.
Well, let's talk about a couple of I suppose in a way curios in your career. One of them is the adaptation of A Life Less Ordinary. That was in the 2000 AD in the 1997, an adaptation of the Danny Boyle film. Not often those kind of things come along. Ever since sort of the death of the comic book adaptation of films that I regularly used to see sort of crop up on the shelves in newsagents. What was it like working on that, where you actually have a work of art that you are just adapting for another medium?
It wasn't wildly different from working on any comic strip. Obviously, the responsibility for translating the film treatment into script form was Dave Bishop's. And he wrote a straightforward, structurally straightforward a comic story. We didn't have the copyright to use the likenesses of Ewan McGregor and Cameron Diaz, which is why they don't really look like Ewan McGregor and Cameron Diaz.
Right.
I think my first idea was to try and make the camera angles similar to the things that Danny Boyle had used, but I quickly realised that was impractical. And I kind of settled on this idea of making it look sort of like Love and Rockets.
Right.
Jaime Hernandez.
Yeah.
Style. But obviously coloured. It was a fun project to do. It was different. It came about almost by accident because Lifeless Limited, who were the production company for A Lifeless Ordinary, got in touch with the office asking how to go about getting a comic strip produced for A Life Less Ordinary, at which point, I think Steve Mack was still working there at the time. I mean, Steve and Dave said, well, you know, we can do that for you. we'll run it in the magazine.
Yeah. Because it's something that we as a comic have not done very often, and there's, you know, been varying degrees of success. So we had Life Less Ordinary, and there was the Simon Pegg Shaun of the Dead one-off strip that Fraser Irving drew when that was at its high. But it's interesting that Steve and David decided on going with you. Was this something that they thought, well, this is perfect for Steve, or was it just that you were looking for work at the time?
I don't remember that I was looking for work at the time. I think they just wanted someone they'd worked with, because it was all quite short notice.
Right.
I think they kind of just wanted to touch base with someone they'd worked with before. That they felt was I'd like to think that I was reliable.
Yeah.
I think it was just as purely as practical as that.
Okay. You also worked with the late Steve Moore on Red Fang, which I described this in Life Less Ordinary as curios, but that's not quite the right word. They're more just kind of strips that never felt as if they fitted into, you know, preordained slots that 2000 AD had. And with Red Fang, you seem to be able to really indulge in that kind of slightly Disney-esque, everything very rounded feel to it. Tell us a bit about that strip and working with Steve. I mean, he was one of the giants of British comics.
Yeah. It was interesting. Steve, he was very knowledgeable on China, Chinese history, Chinese mythology, and that was. That made itself felt when I was turning in the first few character designs to him, because he didn't want characters to have not ponytails, sort of plaited ponytails at the back, which is the classic Western stereotype of Chinaman. My bad for doing a stereotype, but he pointed all these mistakes out, and he was very big on making sure that the Chinese culture is reflected properly through the strip. I hesitate to say traditional, but it was more of a sort of space opera kind of a story, rather than it wasn't dystopian, let's put it like that.
Right.
It was his own sort of unique self-contained universe, wasn't it? If that makes sense.
Well, the reason I bring it up really is because it seems very much that your style, with its economy of line and its adaptability, is able to suit so many different kinds of strip. So over the course of these two episodes, we've talked about superheroes, we've talked about pirates, we've talked about science fiction, we've talked about dystopia, we've got a martial arts kind of mythological series, we've had a film adaptation, we've had straight sci-fi action adventure with robots with human brains in them. There aren't that many artists who even at 2000 AD who can claim to have a style that suits all of those things. So what do you think it is about the way that you work, the way that you approach your artwork, that means you're able to adapt to all these different things?
Well, I think we're going back to those classic influences again, aren't we?
Right,
back in the day, the 50s, 60s, 70s, you were expected to be adaptable. Off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of some of the varied projects that an artist like, Jeff Campion drew. I mean, he drew Westerns, didn't he? He drew science fiction, he drew war comics. He did everything.
Yeah.
And all those guys could. But it was expected of them. And I guess because I'm as influenced by that period as I am, that I'm able to, look at these diverse projects, and not think, oh.
Well, I think you your work sort of sits as a kind of a bridge between, as we've talked about, that kind of older generation who were expected to do all of those things and be adaptable, and the new style of comics, which is full of its pop culture references and its more violent action and stuff like that. Do you feel, I don't know, what's the word? Privileged, happy, comfortable to kind of sit between those two different eras?
Yes, I have no problem with that at all. If I can straddle those two eras, then that suits me. That's a great place to be.
Yeah, and I suppose it speaks to 2000 AD's place in comics that you can do all those different things in one place. We even describe ourselves as a sci-fi action comic, but it's so much more in there, all under the same roof.
Yes, it's long since ceased to be a science fiction comic, really, hasn't it? It's kind of science fantasy. Is that a more encompassing phrase?
Science fantasy, historical
horror.
Whatever you want to do, basically.
Whatever you want to do. I don't know. There must be a phrase for it. There must be a genre. An
anthology, I think. Yeah. But I mean, you referenced the freedom a little while ago, staying at 2080, being able to do the kind of things that you want to do. Looking to the future, is there first off, is there something that you've not done that you would like to do in the future? Is there something you would like to do more of? Where, after this career that's spanned 30 years, where do you go now?
Well, I've never done a love story.
Okay.
I've never really done a war story as such. I've never really done a traditional space opera, space rockets and plastic bubble helmets kind of a story.
So
there's dozens of things I haven't done that I'm sort of very open to suggestions. If any of these, you know, if any projects come through like this, come Mighty Tharg's way.
I can hear Ian Edgington's brain whirring as he's listening to this. Right, what can I do?
Well, I know Ian's brain is whirring at the moment. I was speaking to him only yesterday.
Right. Okay. So yeah, I mean, you know, look into the future. Where do you see your career go from here?
Well, I hope more of the same, I hope.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, as long as I'm enjoying what I'm doing, I'm quite happy doing what I'm doing.
Has the publication of the Apex edition and the fact that Zenith was out of print for so long, has this been a period over the last year or so where you have, you know, naturally just kind of looked back and thought about where you've come from, where you've been, what you've done?
It's starting to. Right. haven't got quite that far yet. I've been too busy, you know, writing little notes for you for the Apex edition. No, I don't like to look back too closely. I mean, you should be looking forward all the time as a creative person anyway, shouldn't you?
You've worked with some amazing writers. You've worked on some amazing characters. What for you have been the absolute highlights of the last 30 years?
To be honest, there's an absolute highlight at some point in every story you do. Because I'm very fond of Zenith, because that's the character I'm most associated with, and he's been very good to me. But seriously, you can't separate out one project as having more highlights than the other, because there's always a highlight in the story at some point. I'm sort of waffling now.
No. It's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. Because I guess the reason I ask is that people's careers naturally rise and fall, and you know, have their ups and downs. And I think, you know, is there the case that after a certain point, you have to find a highlight in whatever you're doing, otherwise it can become routine and dull.
But as long as you're prepared to be open to new things, and as a creative person, be prepared to look beyond the boundaries of your particular medium, if you like. Yeah. I mean, this last year or so, I've been looking at a lot of there's a website called Muddy Colours, which is a fantasy art collective. And these guys, they're all painters, you know, they're all painters, acrylic painters, digital painters, which isn't what I do at all.
Yeah.
And I also read James Gurney's blog quite a lot. You know, James Gurney's artist and writer of Dinotopia. And he's very, very knowledgeable on the traditional atelier schools of the 19th century, those very academic painting approaches that they used, you know, end of the 19th, early 20th century.
Yeah.
But there's always rich seams to be mined if you're prepared to look around for them. And the point is to be open to all these things and to be receptive to all these things. And as a creative person yourself, use these things to grow, for your own work to grow, to take your own work in along down that line.
Because you're still a traditional medium artist, aren't you? There's aside from the scanning, there's no kind of digital manipulation.
Yeah, well, there's little bits of digital cleaning up.
Right.
What I don't like to do is clean up everything on the page. I like to leave little bits of line work where I've gone over the lines. Like, yeah. I sort of leave in. Otherwise, you end up doing what Cosgrove Hall did when they did, I can't remember which movie it was, where they used 3D animation rather than their stop motion puppets, and everything was so clean.
Yeah.
And so refined, it kind of almost lost a little bit of the character. But so the digital is gradually working its way more and more into my methodology, into my workflow. I mean, I think Mike McMahon at the moment uses this strange halfway house between digital and analog. Right. And he'll work up a drawing so far in pencil, then scan it in. And he'll ink stuff in marker pen, scan that in, and drop the black solid blacks in on the computer.
Yeah.
All strange little things like that. And I'm starting to drift a bit more that way myself. You have to do these things just so you've got more tools in the arsenal.
Yeah. No, it's interesting still how many of our artists still work traditionally. But then we have obviously the people who are purely digital. But as you say, the still many more are in that kind of halfway house where they feel that they've got the best of both worlds.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I bring you back to Mike McMahon.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's one of the nice things about the Apex Edition, really, is it's not casting any aspersions, but you know, seeing the imperfections in many ways. You know, the editor's marks and the speech bubbles that have dropped off, or the edges of panels that aren't, you know, look straight when they're reduced down, but then you see them and you say, well, you know, that is a physical brush that has been used to create an imperfect line that still looks great. So it's I kind of guess it's all about character, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I was looking through one of Phil Winslade's sketchbooks he had with him a short while back, and he had these really scratchy, hyper-detailed Phil Winslade drawings. But, you know, there's whiteout all over them.
Yeah.
But it looked great. It was like an integral part of the image. You know, after all, erasing is part of drawing. As someone said.
absolutely. Right, well, Steve, thank you for taking the time to talk to us on the Thrillcast. I really, really appreciate it.
Very welcome, Mike.
It's been a fascinating insight into, your artwork has been with me ever since I started reading 2000 AD, and I think that's the case for many people. So, thank you for talking to us, and thank you for some great moments in 2000 AD.
You're very welcome, and thanks for those kind words, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Brilliant. Well, a huge thank you to Steve for taking the time to chat to us in such depth. I hope you've enjoyed that. I thoroughly did hearing some of the stories about Steve's work at 2000 AD. Back to normal next week. We've got some great guests lined up already. Keep an eye out on our social media for clues about who we're going to be speaking to in next week's Thrillcast. Thank you all for listening. Please do spread the word. Make sure that you tell your friends about the official podcast of 2000 AD. And, Splundig Verthrig, Earthlets. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. That's all for this week. Splundig ver thrig, Earthlets.